Blog Talk Radio.
We're a nation of haters under their control. To rise up everybody and burn down, burn down. The system fails, the exit rules. Wake up the silence, maturity. I'm feeling the love in the chocolate club. I can feel the space between us. Little Capitan and the common man. Time to show them all.
Welcome to yet another episode of the Star Chamber Show. We are here tonight. Stephen and Susan couldn't join us, but Michael West, Alexander Brown, and I, Sarah Janelle, are here to entertain you for the hour. We're going to be interviewing each other and maybe reading some of our stuff and just having a good time. But first, announcement-wise, we have some new releases from Seven Star Press that we're really excited about. Susan Roddy's book, Under Ace, S.H. Roddy, is called Armageddon Rising. This is really cool urban fantasy dealing with a lot of the pantheons and mythologies. If you like that sort of thing, you are really going to want to check this out. Also, recently, Crimson Heart just published Death's Dance, and it deals with the Grim Reaper. It's some really unusual, nice stuff. I picked up both at Imaginarium the other week, and I haven't gotten to start reading them yet. I've paged through, and I'm really excited about both of these books. Now, I think, Michael, you've been doing the con circuit lately, haven't you? You've been doing a lot.
Yeah, in addition to Imaginarium, last week, Seven Star Press had a presence at the Context Convention in Columbus, Ohio, and we had a fabulous time. We did some panels and hosted a party, co-hosted a party with some other publishers, and it was very successful, and everybody had a good time. And I was a guest on the live broadcast of the Funky Werepig Blog Talk Radio show. It was my birthday, so I had some goodies there that were bestowed upon me, and also they had the first ever Windy Run, which is you had to run like Windy from the end of The Shining.
That's beautiful.
And I was the grand champion of the first annual Windy Run.
Oh, congratulations. That's hilarious.
Well, thank you. Congrats.
Thank you. Thank you. There's supposed to be video up later this week, and I'm sure if you check one of our sites or the 7-Star site or something, there'll be a link to it, I'm sure. But and then this weekend, I will be a guest at the Fright Night Film Fest weekend in Louisville, Kentucky, where I will have copies of all my works, including my recent short story collection, Straight Jacket Memories, which I can sign, and I believe I'll be doing some sort of candlelight reading one night during the con.
Ooh, fancy. That's really cool.
I'm excited about
sure
it.
Everyone,
it should be a fun.
Yeah, those are always fun events, and I'm sure it'll be great. So if you're in the area, you need to check that out and see Mr. Michael West.
It'll be at the Galt House in Louisville, Kentucky.
That's a good location, too. That's a really nice hotel.
Yeah, it is.
God, this makes me wish I was in that area just so I could experience the candlelit reading. I've never been able to sit in on one of those before.
No.
They're a lot of fun. You have to kind of know what you're reading because you can't really see it. But
unless you have like a Kindle or a Nook or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you could just make it like improv the whole thing, and people would think you have this amazing story that they can't, this limited edition story that they can't find anywhere.
Right. To see what the story would really look like, you need to buy the book.
Oh, that is hilarious. Well, also, we do have a few little events coming up in my neck of the woods. I know that J.L. Mulvihill, who is the author of Boxcar Baby, she is working on a few events in Jackson, Mississippi. As a matter of fact, one of the events is going to come up on October 25th, I believe it is. And it's actually going to be at a library. Not all the information is complete on that as of yet, but we're still gathering more information as time goes. Myself, we do have a Southern Haunts book signing at Cafe Paradiso in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and it's going to be on Halloween Day. And Cafe Paradiso is a coffee shop slash restaurant, so what we're going to do during the daytime from 11 o'clock until about 3 o'clock is we are going to meet the public, read to the public, and if they have kids with them, we're going to let them trick-or-treat us.
That is a great idea. That's a lot of fun.
Very cool.
Yeah, they have us in right at lunch hour, so it ought to be interesting. All right. Well, I want to start off by saying once again that it was such a pleasure to meet everybody at Imaginarium, especially all of the podcasters here. And it was able to let me know you better than just us being people who interview others and so forth. And when I was able to meet you, Sayla, I was able to learn quite a bit more of your personality and just see you're... No, it's all good. I was able to see that
you're... And now it can never be unlearned.
Yeah.
And I was able to see that you're just a very loving, caring person. And so I just want to ask you a few questions in regards to your writing technique and... also what inspires you. So, yeah, first question, what inspires your writings, especially your standalone novel, Old School?
Oh, gosh. Well, first, thank you for those compliments. That was very lovely. I really, really like ideas. To me, there's a lot of possibility in everything around me. I don't know if I'm just a big romantic or if I just think differently than other people, but I like... walking down the street, I mean, we all get on our own heads about, you know, what's going on in a day or whatever, but I always like sort of looking around and wondering what other people are thinking or wondering different things, and then it, like, goes into other territory. Like, I'll be like, well, what if, you know, what could be living in that bush, or what if this or that is going on? But beyond that, like, for Old School, that especially was a lot of my passions put together in one place. I love folk tales and fairy tales. My dad's best friend growing up in high school, he grew up to be a scholar on the subject, so I've read a lot of his books through the years, and I've always, you know, loved reading this sort of stories. And, you know, I like fantasy and I like all that sort of thing. It kind of was me at a place where it was written out of frustration. Things that happen in my daily life definitely give me ideas and inspire me all the time. I'm kind of one of those, I always just sort of go with it. I'm not trying to make myself look better or whatever. I just kind of bounce off of whatever's happening. So in this case, I was mad at someone, and I didn't feel that a workload was being distributed evenly. So for whatever reason, I didn't see myself as the princess. I just felt like a troll. So I decided to, like, write what would happen if, like, you know, the classic story was reversed and a troll was, like, put upon by a... you know, a heroine. So that's where that kind of came from. But, it, you know, in with all that, it grew to be, you know, all my love of these different genres, you know, urban fantasy, paranormal stuff. I love Lovecraft-type horror, so I threw that in there. It kind of is a tribute to all the genres I like, while I still get to wreck them, because I also like learning the rules to break the rules a lot.
Nice. Well, you've kind of answered my next question, which was, why do you write in the genre that you do? But how about we look at it this way? What elements of those genres interest you to write what you do?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I grew up in the 80s, so I feel like I was really enabled to embrace the light and dark sides of a lot of things, even like the girly cartoons. Like, I mean, Care Bears had like this, the first Care Bear movie had like this Necronomicon type plot. I mean, so to me, it's, I like embracing the light and dark of different things. And I just really am attracted to exploring different, I like magic and I like these unusual characters, but beyond the unusual characters, I really, to me, I think I like getting to know people, you know, to me, it really doesn't matter who you are. You could be, you know, as long as I know you aren't going to punch me in the face or murder me or something, you know, I'll sit down and talk to anyone. I love getting to know people. I don't care if you're the president or a celebrity or like someone I'm just passing the street. I like knowing what people are going through, and that extends to my characters. So for me, it's great to dabble in these or go into these magical genres I really love, but also wonder what it would be like to actually go through that, you know, whether you're a talking animal or someone who's having all this dark magic thrown at you, or, you know, what are you facing as a creature, or what are you facing as this put-upon heroine? That, those things fascinate me.
Okay, awesome. Well, that definitely shines light on the fantasy genre a lot more. Fantasy is not really something that I write in that much. It's something I'm starting to get in more, so it's really interesting to see your perspective on that. Now, what's been the most difficult piece you've written?
Well, the one that I've written so far, I'm working on a couple ideas that are very slow going because it's a very emotionally dark topic matter, but things I've already written, in terms of world building, old school is hard because I had never done something that complex and very, very detailed. But in terms of just maybe learning to write a book and learning to really tap into all parts of myself, there was this book I did, and it's not in print at the moment, but it was called In the Red, and it was kind of this urban fantasy horror version of Hans Christian Andersen's The Red Shoes, but it was through this, about this guy who wanted to be a rock star, and he got these boots from a glam rocker, and he, it bordered into demonology and all this different stuff. But it was, I really had to put him through an emotional roller coaster, and, you know, I didn't like him as a character to start, and it wasn't until I started to empathize with him, and really I had to face a lot of, like, insecurities about myself to sort of get him where I wanted him to be. And that was hard. I mean, it was definitely like, you know, giving myself permission to write all this bad boy rock and roll behavior was hard for the first part. But then the second part, I really had to go into like tapping into his insecurities so he could go through this character arc. And that, I really like had to get honest with myself and like turn it around and how I would feel if I was in that position. And it was rough. It was definitely rough.
All right. Well, I could definitely see where a lot of vulnerability would go into that, and it would also be a roller coaster on yourself mentally and physically while creating that. Awesome. Well, I hope to read this from you one day. I really hope to see it sooner than later.
Yeah. I'll have to send it. I'll send it to you. It's one of those I'm still shopping at the moment, but I'll pass it to you. You can beta for me.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, what style of character is your favorite to write about?
It depends on what it is. You know, personally, and this is, I don't know, I feel like I really like writing complex female characters, for one, because I don't think there are enough of them. And I think when we talk about complex female characters, it tends to either be like someone who's really strong and fierce or someone who's having all this stuff happen to them. And I like to explore, you know, all the gamut of different female personalities. But I also, character-wise, really, I don't know why, I really like to write, like, dirty, bad, awful, perverted, humorous dudes. I don't know why. I mean, there's a Ipik, who's the crotchety troll who says whatever comes to mind, old school, and Clyde, the bird who's also like a source of ancient evil and happens to be a very eloquent pervert. Like, those are definitely in my wheelhouse. And like in my vampire fiction, I definitely have the bad boy vampires who are doing whatever. I don't know why this amuses me, but it does. So there's that.
So he's a charismatic pervert.
Clyde is a very charismatic pervert, yeah.
Okay, well, I can be swooned with those kind, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, what's your favorite setting to provide in a story and why? Like, would you prefer a city setting, a forest setting, a country setting? What's your ideal setting?
I really like small towns, actually. Whether it's making fun of them a little bit or whether it's embracing them, that's kind of the atmosphere I grew up in. And I feel like, you know, to me, I think it's very easy to overlook, like, the small town Midwest atmosphere. And it's very easy to stereotype it. But there's so many little nuances, and there's so many different types of characters and personalities that make up these little places. And, you know, all of them have like their little individual quirks and their little, you know, local things that make them special. And it's really, really, I just love that. I love small towns and that kind of atmosphere. It feels very relaxing to me and very, not even homey, but just very comfortable. So I really like that sort of atmosphere a lot.
Right. Well, that also kind of says a lot about personality as well. And I'm really interested to see exactly how you bring characters into these type of settings. Do you have perhaps some work with you right now that you could share with us and just read a part of so we can see a little bit of your samples? Okay, awesome. Yes.
Sure. I'm going to have to juggle my phone with my book here. But, yeah, this is actually from, I have a very short story here, from a book I did with Susan Roddy called Lost in the Shadows. We kind of put 47 shorts together of different genres and stuff, but this is kind of, I like to do these things where I kind of go off on a topic and just see what happens. And I also let people, like, give me a first line, and this is one where someone gave me a first line, and I just kind of went with it. And it's kind of not one thing or the other, but it amuses me. And it kind of embraces my take on the writing process and characters, too. So this is called Inklings. A zombie, a vampire, a werewolf, and a druid are in a bar. Bottles and glasses sit before each, so they're just a pretense, an excuse for being there. What they're really after cannot be found within the confines of a mug or bottle, cannot be found within the buzz of alcohol. They give the appearance of jocularity in conversation, but they are all on the hunt. All have their senses attuned to the goings-on around them in the little dive. What about that one? The werewolf asks, nodding to a long-legged brunette. She's already been approached by a businessman who's attempting to teach her how to play pool. She knows how, but she lets him go through the motions. The wolf wrinkles his nose in derision at the tableau. He's already transformed, doesn't even try to hide what he is. No one cares in this place. No, the vampire growls after a look up from his phone. Not enough brain cells if she's led that easily. He goes back to texting, unimpressed. Wonder what she's doing here, the druid remarks from the depths of his hood. She doesn't seem the type. Not for this place. He doesn't look at most of those in the bar, not because of the fabric blocks them out, but because there's no reason to. Very few even care about the old ways anymore. And the old ways are what he's bound to. Zombie agrees. A lot of new blood in here tonight, at least, the vampire points out. It's so hard being referred to as just the vampire. Just for the moment, that's all he is. That's all any of them are. A type, a creature a possibility. He wonders if those that come in feel the same way about themselves, or if they know the power they have. A shifter who's currently in the form of a large, sleek panther struts by with a petite blonde, and it's hard to ignore the smug smirk on the lucky bastard's face. I wonder if this is how they feel when things pass them by, the wolf grunts, also distracted by those pairing off. A mermaid clings to a guy that looks to be in college, and a gorgon giggles at the end of the bar with a doctor. Who knows how they feel? It's impossible to know when we're at their mercy, the druid replies with a tired, exhausted sigh. You guys are popular, at least. Who's going to actually take a look at one such as myself? That's why you stick with us, the vampire insists. Someone's bound to notice you with us. It was only mildly comforting. After all of them were shadows of what they should have been, their colors pale and faded against the ambiance of the bar. The zombie sighs and scratches an ear. It falls off into his drink, but he fishes it out, wrings it off, and smacks it back onto the side of his face. He's right. We've been here way too long, the werewolf mutters, digging into the matted fur on his forearm. Boredom sucked, but fleas really sucked. You want to try another bar, then? Do you even know of another place that caters to our kind? The vampire challenges. His eyes wander as a redhead who looked like she'd fallen out of a mall's goth store strides by, eyeing the pickings. Her blue gaze wanders over them briefly, but she keeps moving. She perks as soon as she sees the resident elf rocker sitting up and wastes no time going over there under the pretext of offering help. Who told you she wasn't into any of us? The druid snipes and straightens. Over there. Everyone at the table turns, and the robed one shakes his head so fast he nearly loses his hood. Don't look all at once. Maybe, the werewolf admits, and tries to lean back in his seat, all cool and confident, as he flashed the grin his muzzle would allow. She looks intelligent, at least. Definitely, the vampire hisses and stands and sits back down. Should I go over there? The zombie snarls and tries to get to his feet. It had been so long, though, he only wobbles forward. He's right. Who says she's looking at you? The werewolf challenges, ears flattening. I'm a vampire, the undead replies. Isn't it obvious? Hi there, a soft, tentative voice says. It's the girl they were discussing, but she's not in cocktail wear, not falling out of a camisole or sporting a miniskirt. If anything, her t-shirt and jeans are typical and boring. She shoves her glasses up her nose and pets a strand of hair behind her ear. I've never done this before, but I couldn't help but notice you. And all four at the table perk, nearly falling over each other to get to their feet, drinks knocking over and long since neglected. They give each other a told-you-so looks and wait. The zombie finally asks. Yes, which one of you are you talking to, my dear? The druid asks. It's been a long time since he's had to be smooth, but if it means moving down pleasantries, he'll do his damnedest. He smooths his robes, fussing with the ornate embroidery that he's never noticed there before. Chick's love wears, the wolf insists, and puffs his buff chest out, though it's hard to see his definition under the gore and hair. He frowns and glances down. Is that blood there a minute ago? No, vampires are always going to win out on that one, Lucian insists, and Estrada realizes that he finally has a name. The leather gear he's suddenly dressed in intrigues him. He wouldn't have pegged the girl for those kinds of thoughts. He flashes a dazzling smile down to his fangs, and long auburn hair moves as he approaches her. Isn't that right, beloved? He's startled by the mix of old and young, and wonders what's going on in that head of hers. Gentlemen, isn't it obvious by our current transformations? Bob Anderson, once a rebel against the viral project his government team was testing, and now a zombie cuts in. And the others blink to see that he already had the girl by the hand. His rotting teeth curve into a pleased grin, and his patches of hair wobble with his head. His suit is musty and worn, his biology cane, but it doesn't put the girl off at all. Actually, I was thinking all of you, if that's okay, she explains, a faint blush on her cheeks. I don't know if it's conventional or if I'm supposed to do this, but I want what I want, she whispers, dark eyes flicking down to the floor, then back up. And I want all of you. The breaths catch. Of everything they assumed and had planned, this was a development none of them saw coming. Are you sure? Lucian asks, suddenly unsure if he can live up to the demanding task. He shares a glance with Cal the Wolf. When did he know his name was Cal? And sees the same hesitation in his eyes. You sure you can handle all of us? Cal barks and looks down at the stained denims and motorcycle jacket he's now wearing. His calling has come back, and he looks to have grown a couple feet, making him even more lethal, more dangerous. The girl smiles calmly, though her eyes dance behind her glasses. I think I can. There's nothing I love more than a good idea, and you, gentlemen, are some amazing ideas. You'll be phenomenal characters for what I'm planning, she breathes. Olhan, the high priest of the lost forest of Yuna, bows low and takes her other hand. Then it is our pleasure to accommodate you, young one. You obviously have a deeper understanding of us than even we did not see at first. They walked out in the little group into the night, leaving behind Inklings, the bar that catered specifically to ideas without a home, and the authors that look for them. Ta-da!
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
I want to see the zombie nights.
Yeah.
I would love to see how you wrote these zombie vocalizations.
Kind of just a bunch of letters strung together. Oh gosh, yeah, it's a weird and wild place inside my head. But enough about me. I'm going to turn the tables on Michael. So, Michael, what inspires your writings? We're going to go back. Sorry. Do you feel the need to defend the speculative genre you write in?
Not often, no. It depends on the audience. Sometimes, you know, if people, you know, say, you know, oh, you're a writer, and I say, what do you write? And you say, well, I write, you know, mainly horror or urban fantasy and whatnot. And then, but I've rarely had anybody go, oh, you know, most of the time when I'm, you know, encountering people and talking about my writing, it's at a convention or a signing or whatnot, and it's obvious that, you know, I'm a writer and what I write. You know, I mean, if you meet me on the street and you see the T-shirts that I wear and whatnot, saying that I write horror is not going to come as a big surprise.
No. It's pretty much right there, which I love. Okay, so for you, what is the hardest part of writing professionally that most people don't consider? Because you seem so put together and so just have a handle on it all.
Oh, thank you. All lies. For me, I mean, the hardest part of the writing process is just getting that first draft out. I'm kind of weird in the way that, you know, most writers do not like the editing process. They would love to, you know, get the ideas out of their head, get them on paper, and then just be done with it and never have to touch it again. But for me, the worst part is just trying to get the ideas out and getting a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the fun part for me is taking that, you know, I look at it like a sculptor with a block of marble. It's like I've created this block of marble, and now to, you know, chip away at it and form it into, you know, the final piece is what I find exciting.
That's awesome. And as an artist, I totally get that metaphor. And that's a really, really good way to put it. As an author, what do you want people to think of when they hear your name or, you know, see it on a book cover? What do they want people to associate with you?
Well, I just want, you know, if people see my name on a book cover hopefully one day on a movie poster or whatnot. I just want them to know that they're in for a good time. I want people to associate me with characters that they care about and stories that they care about. And I want them to see my name on the cover of a book or, as I said, a movie poster or anything really, and just know that no matter what the story is about, they're going to have a really, really good time reading it or watching it.
Excellent. Yeah.
All right. We actually have a call-in. We have a gentleman on the line who has a question for Mr. West.
And let's just bring him in. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, Mr. West is right here for you.
Okay, let me just say, first of all, I've been a big fan for a long time. I think I've got everything you've ever done. Been reading everything, all your short stories, all the way back to The Wide Game and everything. So I'm a really big fan of yours. I did have a question for you about, I know that you started off early on, you did some film work. I know you got an IMDb listing and everything. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and how that all came together and what you did on that one. So I think I seen it about, wasn't on Cable Access in Indianapolis a long time ago?
Yeah, when I was in college, I did when I first started off, I started off as a producer, writer, director for educational television here in Indianapolis. And so I did a lot of programs, and I usually tried to find some horror slant to it. We did one that was called Teen Terrors, where we took, did interviews with psychologists and whatnot, talking about the stress and anxiety that teenagers face. But we would do the host spots, and I was playing the host, and we would shoot them at like haunted houses and graveyards and whatnot, and just try to bring the horror element out of it. I did do a short film with commercials. It would be like an hour long TV program, but it was basically again, it was a time travel kind of my riff on the. On the Terminator, where a gentleman basically sells out the secrets to the Earth Defense System to a race of aliens in order to stop bloodshed, and ends up being double-crossed. So he decides to go back in time to stop a probe from, that first drew the aliens to Earth. He tries to go back in time to stop the launch from even happening, and in the process he meets his wife before he met her. Before.
Well, if I can say one thing, I think it's, I've seen it. I taped it off there one time, had a long time ago on a videotape. I probably lost it by now, but I think it was better than The Terminator and The Terminator 2. And I thought the effects were better, and I think you want to maybe think about, putting that out on DVD and selling that some of your book signings and whatnot. Just thank you for. All you did, I hope you keep on writing, and I look forward to meeting you one day.
Oh, well, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for the call-in. Were there any other questions that might have been there? Or we've already got disconnected there. All right. Well, that was awesome. Always good to hear from fans. Now, Mr. West, do you have perhaps a part of a story or novel that you might would like to share with us tonight?
Sure. I can read the opening of a story called Sandwalkers that is in my new short story collection, Straightjacket Memories, that's out now in paperback and Kindle, and I'll have copies this weekend at the convention. But I can go ahead and read the beginning of that if you'd like. I'll go ahead.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Go for it.
Yay.
Okay.
Scary. Hell yeah.
All right. Here we go. Sand. Sand was the enemy. It gummed up chopper motors, turned fierce warbirds into flightless metal hulks. It jammed M16s, left deadly weapons nothing more than impotent weight, left soldiers defenseless in battle. And when propelled by Afghanistan's merciless wind, it scoured body armor and skin alike. Foster wore the same armor and helmet as the Marines he now shadowed through the sandstorm, but he didn't belong to their ranks. The soldiers of Bravo Company knew it the moment they laid eyes on him back at the outpost. They saw his Nikons, his hard shell cases for his video gear, and his MacBook Pro slung over his shoulders, and their heads wagged. Matching body armor, no matching body armor, journalists stood out like a sore thumb and made easy targets for Taliban snipers. In previous wars, reporters were viewed as non-combatants, no different from unarmed civilians. Sure, covering the front lines was dangerous work, and of course there were casualties, but they were few and far between. In war, however, things change rapidly, and rarely for the better. journalists were now viewed as a cog in America's military propaganda machine, and as such, they were fair game. Sand collected around the edges of Foster's ballistic goggles. He pressed his handkerchief firmly against his nose and mouth. The Marines' weapon-mounted lights were now barely visible through the gritty murk ahead. Foster quickened his pace, tried not to lose sight of the shadowy figure in front of him. The holstered 45 that hung from his belt hammered his hip with each hurried step. He knew these sandstorms could develop without warning, but he'd never seen anything like this. He'd watched dust clouds bubble up, forming a mountain on the horizon, a churning mass that rolled toward Bravo Company like a wave and swallowed them whole. "Where's this village?" Master Sergeant Conlon yelled, and his voice was nearly lost to the wind's roar. "We need shelter fast," another voice called out from the veil. "Just ahead, sir." Was that Corporal Ross? Yes, had to be. He was on point. In moments, structures loomed out of the sand like a Gothic cathedral. The Marines hugged a stone wall, proceeded with caution. They didn't expect to dodge sniper fire in the storm, just as they didn't expect the town elders to form a welcoming committee. But they weren't taking any chances. Wooden poles materialized, a framework for awnings. Tarps, ripped from their moorings, now flapped in the gale like tattered flags. Foster noticed they were not traditional Afghan colors, no. They were red and white, the motif of Arab insurgents. Corporal Ross... Sorry about that, I have to turn the page. The problem of live radio. Corporal Ross noticed it too. He ducked beneath these tarps and swept their paths with his eyes, leveling the barrel of his M2, nicknamed Ma Deuce. The heavy machine gun was his best friend in theater. He found a locked entrance and motioned them forward. "McBride," Conlon called. "You're up." Private McBride spoke both major Afghan languages, Dari and Pashto. He put his gun aside and knocked on the door, shouting greetings in both tongues. No response. "Try Arabic," Corporal Miller chimed in. His eyes moved from those tattered flags to Conlon. "Want me to break it down, Sarge?" "Move on," Conlon ordered. "Look sharp, people." The Marines resumed their march. They strode single file, weapon-mounted lights illuminating their immediate surroundings and little else. The opposite side of the street was a specter in the sand. As they moved deeper into the village, Foster was reminded of a Wild West ghost town. Wind howled between scattered brick structures, buffeting Bravo Company with grit and bits of trash. An old-fashioned motorcycle lay riderless on its side in the dirt street. A propane tank sat on one end of a vendor's makeshift scale, but the other side, now full of sand, weighed more. A metal sign rattled with every gust, but there were no goats, no dogs, and no people. No signs of life at Jesus, Miller called out. "Would you look at this shit?" Foster glanced over and saw the severed head of a camel. It was tied to a post along their walkway, swinging in the wind like a pinata. Blood dripped from its ragged stump, splattering dirty steps below. Its eyes were wide, and its tongue hung out like a wolf in one of those old Tex Avery cartoons. "Sick fucks," Miller concluded, his eyes locked with the animal's glassy stare. Probably the village elders' ride. Cocksuckers cut off his head as a warning. "Wounds too jagged," Corporal Harrison corrected. Bravo Company's medic approached with care, sensing a possible trap. His eyes darted between this mutilation and the sandy void beyond. He touched the bloodied stump with his gun barrel, spun it around to get a better look. This baby was ripped off, not cut off. Foster reached for his Nikon and snapped a quick photo. Soldiers spun instinctively toward the flash. Miller aimed his rifle squarely at Foster's chest. The journalist lifted his hands in surrender, the Nikon swinging from his neck on its strap. Miller glared at him. Fucking shutterbug. Save it, Cullen snapped. Let's move. Sure thing, Sarge. Miller backed away, but his weapon never lowered. Foster hesitated, then followed along with his companions, feeling more isolated, more alone than ever before. The wind whistled its happy tune, taunting him. He glanced back over his shoulder and saw that the post had already been swallowed up by the blowing sand, taking the bloody camel head with it. Ross slowed as another entrance came into view. He nodded to his right, and McBride moved quickly to flank him. Conlon crouched at the door. The knob turned easily, and a gust of wind pushed it in. McBride shouted bilingual greetings, waited, then said, "Nobody's home. Nobody's answering. There's a difference." Conlon peered into the silent darkness, then eased out of the way and motioned Ross forward. The corporal stepped in, Modus preceding him through the door. He illuminated every dark corner, eyes and weapon moving in unison, trigger finger ready. Nothing rose up out of the shadows to challenge him, however. "Clear." Conlon led them into the shelter. McBride and Harrison were right behind him. Foster was last, accompanied by Miller, who closed and bolted the door behind them, blocking out the wind. In the glow of their surefire lights, Foster saw evidence of a struggle. Chairs and tables overturned, ceramic bowls strewn over dusty floorboards, some already shattered, others breaking beneath the soldiers' boots, and, most disconcerting, dark stains on the walls. Foster didn't need to be a medic to know they were dried blood. McBride saw it too. Merry fucking Christmas. Foster nodded, surprised that he'd nearly forgotten the date. That was the angle of his piece, after all, how these men coped with being separated from their families during the holidays. Now he didn't know what his story was. If the others noticed the blood in shambles, they gave no indication. Miller remained on guard by the door with his shouldered M16. Ross stationed himself on the opposite end of the mess, Modus still at the ready. His hulking frame filled the darkened archway that led to the next room. Harrison flanked him, his eyes on Conlon, waiting for orders. He didn't have to wait long. "Don't get comfortable, people," the master sergeant cautioned. "Give me a sweep. If there's so much as a flea in this motherfucker, I want to know." They went into the next room, the Marines' movements as choreographed and precise as a ballet, though Foster thought these battle-hardened warriors might take offense at the comparison. Foster's gaze darted left, then right, following the lights projected from their weapons and wishing for his own set of night vision goggles. There wasn't much to find in this modest dwelling, and what little there was had been ransacked. A few pictures hung on the walls, their glass cracked, their frames askew. Long pillows were scattered about, torn open and bleeding stuffing. Hand-woven rugs that had once covered the wooden floor lay bunched up to one side, as if something had been dragged across them. And, of course, there was more blood. It decorated the walls like modern art and streaked the naked floorboards. There had been a massacre here, that much was clear. But there were no bodies, no bullet holes, no signs of explosives, or Ross held up his hand. The Marine stopped, listened, and then Foster heard it too, rapid breathing. At first, he thought it was the sound of his own nervous respiration, but no, they were not alone in the room. The soldiers whirled around, their lights spearing a floral-printed sheet that hung on the far wall. Ross pointed and took a step toward it. McBride nodded, covering him. Foster felt his entire body tense. Writers had active imaginations, and right now his was feeding him every conceivable horror that might be lurking behind that curtain. His hand left his Nikon, traveled down to his belt. He popped the snap on his holster, ready to draw his .45 with the speed of a gunslinger. Ross reached out, curled his fingers around the edge of the curtain, then yanked it aside. Two Afghan children cowered in the light, a girl and a boy. They were filthy, emaciated, their eyes just as wide and staring as the camels that hung outside, but they were alive. The girl was a teenager, covered in a long, brightly colored dress that was now smudged and torn. Dark hair trailed from beneath her tattered headscarf, hiding half her face. Tears had cleared lines in the dirt on her exposed cheek. The boy was much younger, perhaps 6 or 7, and his once white clothes were covered in so much blood that they now appeared tie-dyed in the light. The girl held up her hands and said two words in perfect English: "Don't shoot." And for the rest, you'll have to get the book.
Wow.
Damn
is right. Oh, my God.
That's not the only reaction I can have at the moment. Oh, my God. Yeah, now I'm going to have to, like, go grab my book that's right, like, 4 feet from me and read that before I go to bed tonight.
Oh, yeah. Like, read that before you go to bed. That'll be good.
Oh, dang it. You don't know who I am, Michael. All right, Alex. Do you want to read your selection before we go to questions so you can get that in?
Sure. I'll do that.
Okay.
I am going to read a few pages from my novel, Cerinthia. It is not a Seventh Star Press book. It is actually published by Dark Oak Press. And Seventh Star, they mostly take care of my work that's young adult related until my new novel comes out with them, which I believe is going to be called The Looking Glass Creatures. Not too sure on the title yet. We're probably still going to change it up. But Cerinthia Falls is intended for adults only. So here we go. When the digital clock near the bed read 12:45 a.m., Cerinthia had been sleeping for 45 minutes. Sarah lay in bed, gripping the collar of her shirt with wrinkled knuckles, her brow dressed in sweat from fear of being caught. Directing her eyes to the pants crumpled on the floor, she recalled the pair had $5 and odd cents in the right pocket. To the left of that, two crumpled socks were stuffed in sneakers. Looking to the window, a blue, eerie glow shone in from the moon. Sarah lay on her right side and looked over her left shoulder. Cerinthia's back faced her, making it undetectable if she were sleeping or not. In the softest whisper, she called, "No answer." "Cerinthia?" Still no answer. She turned back to the digital clock, 12:46 a.m., She threw the covers off, then lay there, allowing Cerinthia time to readjust if the movement was disturbing. Seconds passed. Sliding her legs off the mattress, she moved into a sitting position. Looking back over her shoulder, Cerinthia rested. In that same sweet crooning whisper, "Cerinthia?" No response. As she stood up from the bed, the box springs breathed. Sarah's teeth clenched together, hoping the beast remain undisturbed. Turning to face the bed, Sarah noticed Cerinthia slept in peace. Focusing her attention on the carpeted floor, she snatched up her clothes and shoes. She tiptoed to the door, then whispered one final time, "Cerinthia," while observing her sleeping friend. With her back to the door, Sarah twisted the cold brass knob. "Creak," sounded from behind. Eyeballing the bed, her stomach muscles were overcome with an aching paralysis. Once everything settled, Sarah advanced into the hall, then secured the threshold. In the dark, she slipped into her pants, socks, and shoes. Dressed, she began down the hall and into the kitchen, then continued outside. Leaving the front door unlocked, she ventured across the lawn as wet leaves clung to her shoes. The fall chill shook her, and she wanted to re-enter the home to retrieve a jacket, but was unwilling to press her luck. Suffering the coolness of the night, she began into the subdivision. The wind howled. It reminded her of that fatal Friday when everything was assumed to be safe, but adventure found a dark twist. She began feeling nervous with butterflies invading her stomach. She froze and looked over her shoulder, expecting to see Cerinthia transformed, bloodthirsty, and starving for fresh meat. No matter how comfortable her solitude, doubt remained. Sarah rounded the corner and paused, expecting to hear some villain's footsteps following. Nothing materialized. Without the desire to turn and face what could be hiding behind a tree or camouflaged in the shadow, she swallowed hard and continued the journey. The school entered her view. Pausing, Sarah realized she wasn't ready. However, she had no other choice but to investigate. Walking from under the umbrella of shadows, she noticed at the top of the hill in the teacher's parking, Derek's truck. Once standing in the moonlight, the high beams to the vehicle were activated as the motor cranked. She continued walking as the vehicle coasted downhill. After reaching the stop sign at the base, Derek met her where the driveway intersected with the curved road. After opening the passenger's door, an inviting temperature greeted her. Derek asked, "Ready?" as she climbed into the cab. "As ready as I'm going to be," she replied. The radio was off, and only the purring of the motor growled into the night. The truck turned left at the fork in the road. Sarah glared to the road at her right, dreading the memories of that malicious orgy of trailer trash land. Derek's hand shook her left knee, causing her to flinch. "You all right? You weren't breathing." She hadn't noticed the pause in her breath. She was too occupied by bad memories. She admitted, shamed, "That's where I used to live." Again, she didn't attempt to elaborate, but Derek pried for further details. "Did they cause your bruises?" He appeared hungry for knowledge and didn't seem like he was trying to abuse her trust. Instead, it felt like he wanted to learn her and maybe assist with her needs. Considering Sarah lacked in the friend department, she determined it wouldn't hurt to open up. "Yeah, Dad did, but Mom didn't do anything to help, so she's just as guilty. I'm sorry." The apology sounded sincere, yet it didn't fix the past and wouldn't improve the future. Nonetheless, it felt good to have a teenage male willing to play therapist. The last boy who did this was Danny, and although he could be obnoxious, he knew when to be serious and care. "It's not your fault," she soothed. "I know, but I wish it wouldn't have happened." His wishes and sorrow made her feel too vulnerable. It was time to lighten the situation. All right, and I'm going to cut it just a little bit short because we are running on our last 10 minutes, but I can guarantee you that they are driving into a big mistake.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to go, "God, man, God." Oh. Damn it, Alex. All right, just for that then, what I want to know from you is, what is the favorite thing that you've written and why?
Oh, God. A favorite. Wow, you've really kicked me there. all right. Even though I haven't written the entire Southern Honks books, the Southern Honks books hold a special place in my heart because it feels like it's a group effort of many authors and artists and people just coming together who share the same vision. That is deeply in my heart. Cerinthia Falls is probably the closest thing to home that I can possibly speak about. When I was writing Cerinthia Falls, it is a coming-of-age novel that just happens to be about werewolves, and a lot of the scenes that took place in this book, I had to ask my friends before writing them. I said, well, do I have your permission to write this? This is really hitting close to some of the things that you suffered in high school, such as child abuse, peer pressure, sexual abuse, so on and so forth. And so I gained their blessings, and of course I kept it fictional to the degree where, you know, if someone were to read it, they can't say, "Oh, well, this happened to so-and-so." So in regards to Cerinthia Falls, I feel it's closer to me in an emotional growth. Traumatized that Pro Se Publishing has under their belt, that's pretty close to me as well, because that's actually my first writing a short story collection. And so many of those short stories reflect different views that I had in the time that I wrote it. So metaphorically speaking, that would be close to me in that sense.
I love that, because it feels like you're just so multifaceted, and your answer really shows that. That's really awesome.
Thank you.
So then, you're welcome. You know what I like, yeah. With that in mind, then, what character of yours do you connect with the most?
Honestly, I would have to connect with Cerinthia the most. In Cerinthia Falls, I base a lot of her school experience on how elementary school had been for me. I was the outsider, the kid who would sit on the side of the school playground reading Stephen King or Clive Barker or whatever. And so Cerinthia in a human form is more so the experience I had from, I'd say, elementary school to junior high, a little bit of high school, not too much, though. And pretty much due to the bullying that she receives, the metaphor of her being a beast is really how the cruelty of other people can bring out the beast inside of us.
That's definitely true. That's a really, love that. I'm definitely, I just want to read that now. Like, now I want to find out what happens. Oh.
Ah, shit goes down. I'll say that, shit goes down.
Well, you'd think we were trying to actually get people to read our books or something. Gosh.
I know, right? Gosh. Oh, my gosh.
By the way, I just want to go in and comment on the two pieces that y'all read. Sayla, I loved your story. It was kind of like, oh my God, reliving a Friday and Saturday night, but with monsters, which made it so cool. And then, Michael, your story, it's like...
It was basically
oh
us at the troll pub.
It was us at the troll pub.
Yes, indeed. And Michael, with your story, I mean, the way you described the camel's head, that was really cool.
Oh, my gosh,
so,
yes.
Major kudos to both of you.
Oh, well, right back at you, because I feel like both of you just make me want to grab your books and read them right now. Like, right now. Like, I'm about ready to hang up the phone.
I will say this much. With Cerinthia Falls, I do urge reader beware. I feel that the novel has a very strong social message to it and a message of awareness that even though the book is not suitable for young adults and suitable for adults only, I feel that there's a message that adults can bring out of this and apply to the awareness of their children. And when I went into writing this, I knew right away that I wanted to focus on child abuse, child neglect, peer pressure, bullying. I wanted to focus on all that. And at the same time, some of my favorite horror was Stephen King's Carrie and the American Werewolf in London movie. And so it kind of came to me, well, what would happen if I combined the two?
Very cool.
Well, gentlemen, I think it's been a very good night.
We should give people links of where they can find us.
Yes, I was just going to say, yes.
All right, y'all
go ahead.
First.
Ladies first.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank
first.
You. Thank you. Well, on Facebook, I've had to take a little bit of a hiatus during the summer from my media, but I'm really intent on getting back into it now. Facebook, you can find me at facebook.com/SayLaHJAH. My blog is SayLaHJANEL.wordpress.com, I think. Yeah. And
okay.
That always eludes me. But yeah, I know. If you Google Sayla Janelle, SayLaHJANEL, it'll take you to my blog. Otherwise, on Twitter, I'm at Sayla Janelle. But those are me.
Awesome, Michael. Your go.
Okay. Well, you can find me on my website, which is bymichaelwest.com, bymichaelwest.com. Or on Facebook, which is the same Facebook. I'm at my limit of friends on regular Facebook, but if you go to, I do have a page, and I can have as many people like my page as possible, and that is By Michael West Page. So it's facebook.com/By Michael West Page, BY. And then I'm on Twitter, /By Michael West as well. And you can find my books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Nook, and Kindle, as well as in paperback. And if you go to the publisher's page, 7starpress.com, you can. There are still some limited edition hardcovers available as well.
Awesome. Well, as far as Alexander S. Brown is concerned, just type my name in on Google and I will pop up for Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and God only knows what else. And if you were to, back in the old day, yeah. But if you go to my WordPress page, traumatizedalexanderSBrown.wordpress.com, that should get you into my blog. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can access any bookstore in America or out of America, for that matter, and order copies of Southern Haunts 1 and 2, Traumatized, and also Cerinthia Falls.
All
available
right.
Well, in the paperback.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, it has been a great evening, and I hope everyone
Likewise.
Had as much fun as we did.
Oh,
right.
Yes, I want to have
a
campfire now and have us all tell stories. So,
yes,
in the future.
That'd be great.
Awesome.
Yes, I think we should. Well, join us back
all
here next week. We'll have more fun stuff. So, have a good night, everyone.
All right.
Good night,
everyone.